It's time to unleash your inner cowboy with the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Now here's your host, Alyssa Barnes.
Hello and welcome to episode 38 of the Earn Your Spurs podcast. I'm your host, Alyssa Barnes. I'm glad to have you with me today because I have a pretty exciting announcement to make. The last few weeks, I've been talking about the Cowboy Champion Summit a lot, and I'm really excited to bring you the information that these speakers have to share because I think it is going to impact you a great deal. As you know, the summit kicks off with a live session from Kayla Mussel, and she'll be talking about how to turn your dreams into goals. But there are some other really amazing sessions that will cover things like how to really be mindful and in the moment and perform at the best of your ability. This applies to whether you're competing or even just taking a recreational ride. And we'll be talking about other things like how to balance your horse life with the rest of your life. And if you're running into problems with your horses, how you can break those down and tackle them in small, bite-sized chunks so it seems a lot less overwhelming. It's truly amazing how you can really tackle any problem using that method. And there's a whole lot more beyond that. Now, when I first announced the summit, if you checked it out at all, you probably know that the majority of the event was originally ticketed, meaning you could get access to the kickoff session for free, but if you wanted to take a peek at the additional speakers' recordings, there was a fee attached to those. Now, I say was because I made the decision to open those sessions up to everyone. There's so much valuable information from these speakers, and I just really want it to be accessible to everyone. So what that means is during the first week in June, when the summit kicks off, you will be able to watch any of those sessions for free. All you have to do is go to cowboysummit.com and register. Now, if you want to have access to those recordings forever, which I highly recommend because it's super helpful to be able to go back and listen to them again, watch them again, pick up things that you might have missed the first time, there is a fee to purchase those recordings, but it is really, really reasonable if you go ahead and do that now. I'm talking like 6 hours of content, 6+ hours of content for less than it would cost you to take one riding lesson. And with your ticket, you will also get access to the private Facebook community where the speakers will also be, and you can ask them questions and get some feedback on issues that you may be having or pick up some tips for improving your performance. This information is going to benefit you whether you're a recreational rider or whether you're just kind of getting into competition, or even if you've been competing for a little while but you really want to improve. So go to cowboysummit.com and check that out. I am really, really excited to be able to offer the Cowboy Champion Summit to anybody who is interested at no cost. Now, moving on from that somewhat wordy introduction, I would love to introduce you to my guest today. Now, as you might imagine, I am constantly searching Google headlines for stories that I think would be interesting to my audience, you, all my Facebook followers. And in doing that, I came across a series in the High Country News called Ranch Diaries. And it really intrigued me because the author was talking about how she and her husband got into cattle ranching. And it was definitely not through your traditional means. I mean, most of the time when young people get involved in ranching, it's because they grew up in a ranching family. The ranch has been passed down from generation to generation. And it often seems like if you did not come from that background, it's awfully hard to get in to ranching as a profession. But Laura Jean and her husband did just that. So in today's interview, we're going to be talking about what a day on the ranch sort of looks like for them and how they even got started in this endeavor. So without further ado, allow me to introduce you to Laura Jean Schneider. So thank you for being here, first of all, today. I'm really, really excited to have you on the show. I just want to give the audience a little bit of a background on how I found you. So Laura Jean Schneider, you sort of have an interesting background and like a unique way that you got into the ranching business. And I actually discovered you originally from a piece that you wrote. Well, it's actually a series that you're writing for the High Country News about your ranching experiences, the Ranch Diaries. And I thought it was so interesting how you and your husband actually came to be ranchers and what you're doing now. So I would just love for you to kind of share your story of how you kind of grew up and got into it and the path that you've taken that's led you to where you are now.
It's been a varied path. I grew up in Minnesota and my grandparents, both sets of them were farmers. And so I spent a lot of time around and with animals and livestock, but in a completely different context than ranching. I do think that my familiarity with animals has helped along that path, but definitely there really aren't ranches in Minnesota. So as a farm girl, turned 18, wanted to see the mountains, I headed to Montana and got a job working at a camp with the horse program. Horses have always been my first big interest and passion, and I found that riding around out there in the big sky country was something that I could definitely get used to. So the next summer I got a job at a working cattle ranch that had a guest program, working with the guests and the 20 or 30 some horse string that was my responsibility, and found that I was starting to pick up a little bit of the cattle work too, since they ran like 2,000 yearlings in the summer, and I got to get my first taste of what it would be like to learn about cattle, bovine behavior, learn about where I should be positioning myself in order to move quietly and effectively around the livestock. And I really enjoyed it. And since that point, I've just made it a point to incorporate that lifestyle into my life wherever I might be. And now that I'm doing it, you know, that now that we've committed to building a partnership and my husband is managing the Triangle Peak Cattle Company full time, we're committed. We're in. So a little bit of how I got to be where I am.
Yeah, you definitely are committed, and we'll get into a little bit more of that. But something I just wanted to touch on was people sometimes will reach out to me who don't have a background in ranching, but they really want to get into that way of life. You know, they want to experience that cowboy lifestyle. And something I always recommend people do if they don't have any foundation is to go find a summer job on a guest ranch where you can sort of get your feet wet and just get around it a little bit. And maybe you're not doing a job that has to do with horses or cattle per se, but you're still getting that exposure. You're learning more and more as you go. And then once you are able to kind of develop some of those skills, then you can maybe do a little bit more and maybe move from more of a guest position into something more livestock related. So I think that's really interesting that that's the path that you took.
Yeah. And my husband, actually, I met him on a guest ranch as well. Ironically, he had been hired to cook and do some, you know, like light riding. And he ended up getting a rope, getting a great horse, and just kind of going to it. And, you know, soon he was a full-time cowboy, and he took really naturally to the lifestyle as well. But it is kind of funny that we both started in different aspects of a program like that and turned it into something that seemed like a better fit for us. But it was a great opportunity to be exposed to a lot of different things. And you would get a taste, whether you're actually wrangling horses at 4:30 in the morning or not. They're, you know, at their long days, there's not a lot of time off. It doesn't matter if you're mowing lawns or cooking in the kitchen or, you know, shoeing horses. It's a good little taste of what full-time ranch life might be like. So I would definitely recommend that path.
Yeah. And talk about your husband a little bit, because he is from Massachusetts, right?
Yeah. He grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he has a degree from Yale, actually, in architecture. And he gets a lot of different comments on his education and background about, you know, why would you ever choose to do something like this when you could have gone off and done an internship or got a higher degree and, you know, be managing your own firm. But he realized he didn't like to spend long hours drafting in a studio. And again, I think he had a similar feeling to me when he came out to Montana actually to design a house for his mother. He really just fell in love with the area as well. ended up getting a horse and staying. And so the state drove us in both in different ways, but I think for very similar reasons that, you know, there was something about this way of life that appealed to both of us. So he has been working and ranching for the last decade along with me.
That's amazing. That's something I always like to talk about too, because there's so many people who they've never been exposed to the Western way of life. They haven't ever been around horses or cattle. And they look at your husband who has a degree from Yale in architecture and they say, what the heck are you thinking? Why would anybody want to give up this promising, potentially very lucrative career to go be a cowboy? I mean, I don't know how to explain that to somebody who doesn't understand it.
I think that is a tough one. I mean, it's really hard to explain that a life full of long days, you know, little amounts of time off, if any, hard work, basically being on demand 24/7, you know, on call, who knows what's going to happen. A well goes down or a cow is having trouble calving or any number of things that just sort of make everyday life very interesting. It really, I mean, it's either for you or it's not. I don't think that there's really a way to ride the fence on that one. I really think that you have to be a person that's really self-motivated. And I mean, like you mentioned before, since neither of us are from ranching backgrounds and we're first generation ranchers, we have had to learn a lot of this stuff. And we've been lucky on our way to have great mentors and people established in the business who have seen that we were serious about what we wanted to do. And they sort of took us under their wing and showed us, you know, we're still in the process of learning, of course, like every day is a learning opportunity. But I think that that's one of the great myths about, you know, how could you go from this a city person with a degree to now we're living in this little tiny camper without electricity. I mean, we have solar panels, but we're completely off grid. You know, how do you go from that and then, you know, managing a couple thousand head of cattle? How do you get there? And I think if you really want to do it, you can get there, and that ranching can be learned. I think that there's sort of a prevalent myth around the concept of ranching that if your family hasn't done it for four generations, just, you know, step back from the branding pen. Just don't get into that because you don't know what you're doing. And I feel that a lot around ranching specifically. I think that if we had spent 10 years establishing a career in any other area, that 10 years is a good chunk of time to spend doing anything, but it still feels like a lot of people may think that we're still just beginners. We're still just wet behind the ears, but I guess the proof is in what you produce and the job that you do. So, well, we've had a lot of feedback through the years about our age. You know, we're both young. We're just in our early 30s. You know, you guys don't know enough to be doing a management job, or you're not from here, so you're not going to be able to do it or get along with people or really know what needs to be done. And I think that's probably spurred us to be even more diligent about a commitment to excellence and to learning, and to just, most of it has been lots of hours in the saddle and lots of hours in the ground, because there really is no replacement for that when it comes to learning. So that's part of why if you have any inkling toward that it could work for you.
Yeah, that is very true. And I'm glad that you said that, because I think, you know, for me, one of the reasons that I do this podcast and that I started the blog is because I know there are people out there who want to experience this lifestyle, but sometimes people who are fourth or fifth generation ranchers aren't necessarily welcoming to people who want to learn. And I think that's great that you guys have had, you know, supportive mentors along the way. That's not always easy for people to find, and sometimes it can be a little bit discouraging. So I totally agree with you. It's not something you're born with. Nobody is born knowing how to do this stuff. They either learn it from their parents or their grandparents because that's the way they're raised, or you choose a different path like you did and you figure it out another way.
Yeah. That's funny that you say that, because just last weekend we had a couple friends here and we branded about 80 calves, and my roping skills need some work. So sometimes it's hard for me not to get flustered when I'm roping in front of other people. I get just, you know, a little jazzed up, a little more nervous.
Right.
And then I had a new rope. And so that was kind of being a new rope.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of getting down on myself. And my friend Christy is like, you know, nobody is born knowing how to drag calves, you know. And she, from a family of, again, third or fourth generation ranchers. And I just felt so much better that here's somebody who ropes beautifully and super competent, you know, horsewoman is just basically stating the fact that, hey, just because mom and daddy can do it doesn't mean you can do it. And nobody's born with the innate ability to just go out there and get them. So I think that that's important to remember. You got to be easy on yourself.
Absolutely. Everybody started in the same place. You know, it may not have been at the same time, but I totally hear you there because, I mean, I grew up in a horse family. We competed. My dad's a horse trainer. We showed cunning horses. We rodeoed. We did all that stuff. And I've roped a lot, but I still get kind of flustered in a branding pen because I haven't roped a ton in a branding pen. So it's like, it's totally different. It's a totally different environment and the rules are different. And, and the worst part is knowing that there's people standing around watching you that have been doing it their whole lives and they understand the intricacies of it. And you're like, oh, I'm just making myself look like an idiot out here. And they're, you know, what are they thinking about me? But you just have to be able to kind of get over that and just keep doing it.
Yep. It's like, you got to be gentle on yourself and say everybody started. And also it helps to realize like when I'm on the ground crew and everybody else is in roping and I'm helping with the branding, I'm not sitting there watching every shot that every rider makes. You know, I think half of the things we think everybody is noticing and pointing out it, our faux pas are just not even noticed.
Yeah, that's very true. I think a lot of our insecurities come from our own thoughts and not other people's.
Yes, it's mental. I think it is.
So talk a little bit about what you and your husband are doing now in New Mexico.
We are managing Triangle Peak Cattle Company, which is an LLC that we and four other partners put together last fall. Sam and I originally had been looking for land to lease on our own and realized that there was no way that we could find an affordable option that could run enough cattle to make it a profitable enterprise without one of us taking an outside job. And that was one of our biggest and main criteria for finding our own place. So when we were approached with the opportunity of pooling our resources with a couple of partners, it seemed like something we would be interested in. And we decided to go ahead and do it. And it seems like thus far, it's been a really good match. We have partners that are, one was an ag banker, several of them are cattle buyers and have good connections in the cattle sales industry. Everybody has experience with cattle and livestock, and it works out well because we are, in addition to being shareholders, we are also paid to manage the ranch. And nobody else, none of the other partners were in a position where they could move out to the middle of the reservation and set up camp and live here. But it seemed like the best management plan for the cattle and for the country. We have about 90,000 acres leased right now. And it didn't seem reasonable to commute from Ruidoso on a daily basis to try to, you know, cattle need to be managed, in our opinion, closely. And you just need to be around to keep gates closed and an eye on drinkers and that kind of stuff. So we moved out here last October and brought a 320 square foot four season RV that we converted to solar. And we brought our seven geldings and chickens, a Jersey milk cow, our dogs, a couple cats, and settled in. And so far, it's been working out really well. We had to work out a few kinks with camper living. And in the winter, during some cold spells, we had a few frozen pipe incidents, but not bad, nothing catastrophic. And it has been really beneficial to be so close, especially since we started out. Our resident herd is 500 heifers that were all calving out. Some are still calving. So we really felt like it was imperative to be nearby when that was happening. I mean, that's a lot of work and there's no way you can spend 3 hours a day driving to and from town to, and then have a day to actually ride through them. So we also have about 600 yearling steers that we just moved to the other side of our leased country, about 20 miles from where our camp, cow camp number two, is located. And since that, again, is not far as the crow flies, but the roads there are a little questionable and it takes a long time just to get there, we've hired a couple of local cowboys to ride through them a couple days a week. And then Sam usually goes over there once or twice a week, too, just to make sure that everything's looking healthy and gates are closed and to catch up with those guys about what's going on. So right now it's just managing the two different herds. And really busy with branding right now. We have had three brandings so far and probably have about 300 some calves branded. And then on the 17th of May, we're going to have our partners are coming out and we're going to do another branding and hopefully get most everything done but the late calvers. So that's where we are right now.
That sounds like fun. I wouldn't mind coming down and helping you guys brand. So, you know, when I read that first story that you wrote about how you guys started the Triangle P, what really struck me was you and your husband are both young, and it's not easy for somebody, unless it's sort of been handed down, you know, through the generations, the ranch and the cattle, it's not really easy to get started in the cattle business. So was that something that, you know, was really important to kind of put together that partnership in order to get kind of launched?
It was for us. I think you're right that since a lot of ranches, even if they're running a smaller head of cattle, they can be profitable because the land is owned free and clear or has been grandfathered in. And that is not something either of us have the privilege of having relatives with a large ranch to give away. So yes, for us, it was anything that was kind of in the price range we were looking would include a Forest Service lease or a BLM lease, which again brings sort of their own complications and regulations with it. And then you usually just have a small private inholding that goes with each lease or permit. And we also knew that in order to be able to purchase enough cattle to make the operation pay for us, we were thinking about 200 mother cows. And I think between just the cost of the lease or the permit and the cost of the cows, it would, you know, just was not feasible for us to be able to take out a loan for that much money. And even if we had, I don't think we would have been comfortable with that kind of saddled with that kind of a burden at this age. So the partnership did really work. I mean, I was definitely a little bit skeptical. Five partners is a lot of partners. We did not know any of the people very well. We were connected with the man who approached us, a cattle buyer, and knew his brother-in-law well. He had been our cattle buyer when we were working in Luna, New Mexico. But definitely it's been a risk for us. We've been lucky that, you know, all of the partners have been great to work with and extremely supportive of us out here, kind of holding everything together, and they come out and help when they can. But it definitely for us made a huge difference to have some more mature partners with more collateral and just more backing and good relationships with banks, and all of it has been advantageous to us. So going collective seemed to make a lot of sense for us, and I think it did help make it possible. So I would encourage people trying to get into this too, that once you figure out what you need in order to make an operation profitable, because I really like, we're all about the numbers. It's not just a hobby. It's not just something we do because we like to ride around on horses and move cows around. It has to pay for itself. You know, we have to be able to make a living wage from it. So once you can figure out what it takes to do that, if you can get a few people together to sort of collectively use their resources, it seems like that has a potential to really work.
Yeah. And I really like how you guys very much approached it from that business mindset. And I'm sure it helps that you have kind of a more diverse backgrounds in order to approach it that way. I think sometimes people think they want to get into ranching and they really resonate with the romantic ideal of it, but maybe don't really think through all of the more practical implications. So, I think that's really interesting to see what you guys did from an actual business standpoint and being able to turn it into reality without just putting yourselves in an impossible position.
Yes, I think part of what really encouraged us to do that was, first of all, the amount of money that was going to be on the table and that we were taking out in a loan collectively. And as signers on the loan, it was not comfortable to sign something that you can't see how you're going to be able to pay that back to the bank. So also it helped that Sam and I had drafted a business plan for a cooperative called Sweetgrass that's out of around Sawatch, Colorado. It's a natural and organic beef buying co-op. And as they were forming a business, part of our assignment was to create a viable business plan for them. And, you know, 30 some pages later, that was a great, great and sweat-inducing opportunity to really see how to put a business plan together on a smaller scale, but still a serious scale. I mean, things had to add up and work out for both the company and anybody who wanted to become a potential partner. And the bank, of course, in this case, did require a feasible business plan in order to give us the loan. So having a little bit of that experience did help with the process of figuring out, crunching all the numbers and seeing what kind of cattle we needed to run in order to make this work. You know, should we pasture outside cattle? We looked at several different options, and we're still remaining open and flexible to the cattle market and whatever makes the most sense for us. We have these heifers now that are calving out, and they're making some nice little pairs. And our hope is to build and keep a resident herd of mother cows. But you know, if it makes sense to all of a sudden stock the whole place with yearlings, then that's what we'll do. So we're not attached to any one particular way. And I think that that is also an advantageous path to take, because there's so many variables anyway with ranching and the weather and the cattle markets. And I think if you aren't completely fixed to just one species or to one gender, that you give yourself a little bit more freedom to kind of play with what's going to bring the most in the end.
Yeah. And sometimes that flexibility is not found easily in the ranching industry, really, because so often, and we go back to those multi-generational operations that, you know, they've always done it a certain way. And it's hard to sort of be flexible when that's your experience and that's just how it's done. And, you know, that's it.
Well, I think it is good to try to get outside and look at a bigger picture. And maybe because we haven't been just steeped in it since, you know, childbirth, we have a different perspective than some others may have. And while I'm the first person to support traditional ranchers and have learned a completely mind-boggling array of skills and tools from ranchers who do everything the old school way, I think that it is refreshing when you see somebody in their 50s and 60s doing something more progressive. And it always encourages me that, like, things can be learned, things can be changed. Like, there is no end to the learning. I mean, you can ranch for 60 or 70 years and be doing it in a way that may not be the most beneficial, or you could ranch for 60 or 70 years and go through five sort of cycles, you know, of evolving your ranch program from this sort of method of grazing or cattle to who knows. I think the key thing is just to look for the, especially even in looking for a mentor, even if they are dyed-in-the-wool ranchers, the best people to learn from in many cases, is to just see that they are still learning things too. I mean, if people are teaching things and learning things, like, those are the people that you want to learn from, who say, oh, maybe this is a different way. Well, we could try that. That is the attitude that I feel like really does work in your favor, because so much of ranching is really problem solving. I mean, you're always coming up against some sort of situation where you need to figure out what A and B you need to happen to foresee to occur. So I think it keeps you on your toes.
Yeah. And it's sort of a matter of balancing those very important traditions that people are very tied to with more of the advancements in different methods and technology as we go along.
Yeah. And you're seeing it, even though a lot of these crusty old cowboys are now carrying around smartphones, which I find still really hilarious. Even though we ride with ours, it's the only chance we have of getting service. My husband was actually in cell service. He was out on a colt this winter and said that there was a heifer who just calved, whose calf was really cold. And we just had like this ice storm come through. And of course, everything's calving then. It was actually close enough to the house. I was able to take our little Suzuki Samurai four-wheel drive thing out there, go pick up the calf, you know, get some colostrum in it, brought it in the camper, the only warm place, cranked the heat, toweled it off. And in that situation really helped. I mean, he wasn't going to be able to haul a calf back on that green horse. And the cow was pretty set on going back to follow her friends, and she was all confused. So he brought her into the pens. I got the calf warmed up, and, you know, it was a success story. But they come in handy.
Yeah.
You know, you're out there, you're marking and branding like it's 1876, and then just a second, I got to get this call.
Yeah, that makes it fun though. So I have to ask you, how is life living in the camper?
It is cozy. At first I thought, wow, this is so little since we spent most of the summer in a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom house on Sam's cousin's place in Corona, New Mexico. I'm helping them out there. And so we had all this space and a fireplace and 2 commercial ovens and all of this stuff. I was like, oh my gosh, like a kid in a candy store. And then definitely the trailer. We still have, when we moved from Luna, let's see, 1.5 years ago, we put half of our stuff in storage and lived in 2 different houses before we moved to the reservation. And on this last move to the reservation, we put probably another half of our of that stuff in storage. So we probably only have 1/4 of what we actually own with us. And it fit just fine. And well, at first it took a little getting used to, like the 3-burner stove and the tiny oven with the thermostat that's like from 50 to 100 degrees off. I've made some interesting stuff in that oven. These brownies, that a chisel to get them out of the pan, basically. And other nice surprises. But, you know, it works. I've learned its quirks, and it's got a lot of windows inside, which is nice because the view from everywhere is pretty nice and makes it feel like it's a bigger space than it really is. And really, it's perfectly comfortable for 2 people. We don't have a lot of cluttery stuff. And we have a couple bookshelves, and we've got, I don't know, you know, our stuff in here. But it does not feel confining like I thought it might. In the winter, there were some times when it felt a little bit claustrophobic, but there's always the great outdoors to get into. I mean, it's hard to feel claustrophobic out there. So, time to, you know, get on a horse and go ride out, or, you know, get your boots on and take the dogs out on a walk or something. And I've actually enjoyed it. One of my web series essays on tiny living ranch style a couple of episodes ago, just on this very thing, like how does it work? How do you make it happen? And you know, it's really been fine. I wouldn't want to do it for the rest of my life. And right now we're kind of in the process of trying to negotiate where this lease is going, since we have a 1-year lease, which with an option to renew. And we're going to try to see if maybe we can get something more long-term going on. And if that is the case, there is an old house here that would be livable if it was basically, you know, gutted out and fixed up. It's on a foundation and it's in good shape. It's just, you know, critters have moved in and it's not habitable right now. So looking forward to a little more space in the future. But for the time being, I think it's a great experience. I mean, it's just the 2 of us and it seems to be a good fit.
Well, I can tell you, you know, living in Montana, that even if you live in a house, you can still feel claustrophobic in the winter. So. But that is interesting. I mean, like this whole tiny house living movement thing has gotten really popular over the last few years anyway. So you just sort of got thrown into it and now you're seeing the benefits of living with less clutter and stuff around you, I guess.
Yeah. Maybe when Sam actually does get to hopefully design us a house someday, that it doesn't need to be this, you know, it's just something efficient and comfortable, but not with lots of extras. I mean, if you can live in this space comfortably, I think you could. It would be nice to have a guest room. Yeah. We have a guest fold out love seat with the accordion style fold out cloth panel door for privacy. So,
well, that's
just in case you want to come visit, you will have your own room.
So I would love to talk a little bit about some of the other things that you're doing as well as being a rancher. You actually went to school. Did you get a degree in English?
Yes, I'm an English major.
And you do a lot of writing and other things.
Yeah, I try to. So I took my time getting a degree because I didn't really know what I wanted to do and just felt sort of a lot of pressure to go to school, but wasn't sure what for. So I accumulated random credits from like Montana State University and Northwest College in Powell, Wyoming. And then when I met Sam, he really encouraged me to just, you know, if you want to go back to school, this is a good time to go back to school. And now that you know what you want to do, which was be an English major, you know, apply to some good schools. Don't just settle for something that's not going to challenge you. So basically within like the week of Christmas break, I decided to apply to a bunch of schools, most of them on the East Coast. I just got like the Princeton Reviews, whatever, you know, the 350 best colleges book or whatever it is, and sat down and sort of looked like spatially where I'd want to go and what they offered. And I was homeschooled actually and only had a GED, and some schools still you have to have a high school diploma to enter. So that was a factor. And I had never taken my SATs, but I had taken my ACTs. So that was also a factor. So I came up with a list and wrote essays and had a lot of lovely people edit and help assist and write letters of recommendation and got myself together and was able to make like the January 15th deadline. And I ended up getting into the four schools that I applied to, and I went east to visit them, and I decided I picked Smith College, which is a liberal arts college, and it's a women's only college. And I did an accelerated course there since I was paying for my own school. Even though they did give me really generous financial aid, I still was paying for school and wanted to just be efficient with my time and resources. So I worked several jobs when I was there and got my degree in English. And so I graduated in 2010 as probably the oldest person in my class, I'm sure, by a mile. And just last spring, I had been thinking about applying to low residency MFA and writing programs for some time, for the last several years, and just couldn't figure out a way to make it work. And then it seemed like, I mean, most of the programs that have good funding are residency programs. And I knew Sam and I were not going to be moving to Iowa or Chicago or New York for a couple of years so I could get my MFA. So I applied to several low residency programs and I picked Vermont College of Fine Arts. And basically I just go for two residencies a year that are like 10-day residencies. And the rest of the time I work with a professor doing electronic packets of work, and I do my reading on my own. And so it's a great program for someone who's self-motivated and in a remote place like this. And I've loved it. So I'm working on my concentration is in fiction, but lately I've been trying to just write all kinds of stuff. And I've had a couple of short stories published and win some contests. And recently I just had my first nonfiction essay. This was actually pre-High Country News it was accepted, but it just came out in New Mexico Magazine in the May issue about living with the tame pet elk that's around here at our camp and what that's like.
Wow.
There's always something going on out here that encourages me to write about it or to try to look at it in a different way. And so I feel like actually, as far as writing goes, I've been super productive out here. There's not a lot of other outside distractions. And I know that when I set aside that time to write, which I try to do early in the mornings and just get it out, my day just goes so much better. So
I think that you are probably living like most writers' dreams, being out there like in a remote place and just being able to look out the window at the cow elk.
Actually, a friend of mine from college is coming out in a couple of weeks, and she also went to Smith. And we are thinking about, I don't know how it would work here because it's a reservation and a sovereign nation. And I know there would be a lot of permission, but in the future or here or wherever we end up, we were thinking about trying to pitch some sort of a listening thing where they take an art trip to the Grand Canyon, or they do a, you know, geologic study in New Jersey or whatever it is. And we were thinking about just trying to get for the English program. And then for there's a landscape studies program they do that we both were in as well, where, you know, you're studying plants and landscapes and features. And we thought, wow, like how cool would it be to have like host some kind of just get involved somehow so other people can experience this really awesome wow factor that is here in my backyard.
Yeah. and I know you have several, like different websites and stuff online. So if somebody wants to find out more about you and check out some of the stuff that you're writing, where's the best place to send them?
The best place to find out about my writing work is just laurajeanschneider.com. And that has a list of my current publications and a little bit about me as a writer. And I also do a writing blog where I try to post things relevant to writers, and I try to support publications that pay writers for their work. There's a plethora of literary magazines out there for fiction writers to submit their work to, but I feel really strongly about submitting to places that honor the time that you put into creating a polished piece by paying you. So I mean, I think it's important. I think that the whole myth of the poor starving writer just needs to be abolished, because I think people can make a living writing, and I don't think it is a foolish pursuit. And I think that you need to respect your own work enough to basically charge for it. I mean, you wouldn't like bake an elaborate creation and decorate it and say, oh, that's just because I'm a nice person and you'll accept it. Or, you know, you just wouldn't train a beautiful colt for somebody and say, go ahead and enjoy. It was just thank you so much for writing it. And I feel sometimes that the attitude with some of the editors of the magazines that aren't paying is more like, you should be so thrilled that we accepted your piece. And you should, but I feel like if it's good enough, they should be willing to buy it from you. So, mm-hmm. And I noticed, I went to your writing website too, and was really encouraged by just seeing that there are people out there making this work and who are doing both things. Sort of the Royal Ranch thing, and they care about commas, serial commas. They care about good writing and, you know, how something looks and feels and sounds on paper. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm kind of one of those people. I wasn't an English major, but I always was really good at English. So like the bane of my existence is seeing people post on Facebook the wrong there, you know?
I actually feel like I've noticed that so much more, maybe because our just... like people in general, our communication has become so much more casual, but you know, between Twitter and Facebook and everything, people, I think there's been a general decline in the care people are just putting in sort of their proofing and editing. And I'm the first to admit, like, I have to print something out and read it about 40 times before I feel like it's good to go. And even then I still usually miss something. So I'm trying to develop my eye for that better, but I do think that there's an epidemic going on.
Yes, no,
and we need to stop it.
I agree. I mean, I definitely am not immune to making mistakes, but I think people, especially like the younger generation who's grown up with social media and texting, that it's just laziness.
I think that's a big part of it, or just not knowing any different, or, you know, if you just start doing it, why change now? Yes. That good old flexibility rearing its head. So,
well, before we go down this like really long tunnel of you know, grammar and punctuation, I'm going to go ahead and start wrapping up here and ask you the last question that I always ask all of my guests that come on the show. And I'm really interested to hear your answer to this based on your experiences. But what do you think is the most important quality for any good cowboy to have?
I think flexibility, and basically hand in hand with that, a willingness to do whatever needs to be done, whether that's something as nasty and gross as like cleaning out a slimy old water tank or stripping up your shirt and plunging in to fix a broken float, or endless fence fixing. It's not all glamorous. And so I think having a kind of a humble attitude and saying it isn't all this romantic cowboy thing where you're up on a horse trotting around looking glamorous. there's a lot to be said for that. There is. I mean, we've hired people who just don't want to get off a horse to do anything. And well, that's nice and all. It's not very practical. A lot of ranching happens off the horse. So
yeah, that's so true. And I think, you know, when you grow up around that and around animals, especially, like, it's sort of, I think you get kind of immune to it, and you don't, nothing really grosses you out anymore. But you realize when people that aren't used to being around that are exposed to it, and they have like this reaction, and you're like, what is your problem? It's no big deal.
Yeah, you really need to be able to do wide range of different things and just sort of pitch in where you're needed. So I think that the ability to do that will compensate for so much, you know, for a lack of knowledge or anything else. I think if you're just willing to get your hands dirty.
Yeah. That's the best way. That's the best way to learn anything, for sure. Just jump in and get your hands dirty. Well, thank you so much for being here today. I really enjoyed this conversation. We talked about a lot of things that I've been wanting to cover and just hadn't found the perfect guest to talk about it with. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be part of your podcast.
Yeah. And I'll provide links to your website in the show notes and to your series about the Ranch Diaries, because I think people might really enjoy checking that out too.
Great. Sounds good.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Laura Jean Schneider. I thought it was really interesting learning about how they got into ranching and what it's like just living out there in the middle of all of that acreage in a trailer powered by solar energy. I mean, most of us probably couldn't imagine living through a winter. Well, I know I couldn't because I'm in Montana where it's really cold, but, you know, spending a whole winter in a camp trailer because that is your home. But it really just goes to show you what people will do in order to live out their passions. And I think that's truly amazing. It's not about the house you live in or the car you drive or the truck and trailer that you show up to the barrel race in. It's about honoring what is inside of you and living out your dreams. And as Laura Jean illustrated very well by explaining how they were able to get into the ranching business, there's more than one way to skin a cat. So instead of telling ourselves that we just can't do something, it's a good lesson to remember that oftentimes if we think we can't do something, we really just need to look at it from another angle. Because I really do believe if there's a will, there's a way. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of the Earn Your Spurs podcast. I'm so very glad to have you here. I hope you will check out cowboysummit.com and get registered to watch the entire summit the first week of June. I think you're going to get a lot of great information out of it. And just thank you for being here. I really appreciate you. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Until next time, happy trails and spur on.